Thank you for listening to the Just Completed program. If you'd like to offer feedback on any of our programming, please email us at info@wpfw.org.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud, on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Stephen Bion Dolillo. He is the author of Macaroni and Cheese Manifesto. He's also the founder of the National Baseball Poetry Festival. How are you doing today, Stephen?
Great. Great to see you. Thanks for having me with you.
Well, you know, Stephen, your life story seems like one that should be on the big screen. And so I want to begin our conversation talking about the years you spent in an orphanage and how sports and poetry helped you to achieve success.
Oh, so just to sort of take it then back to the beginning where it needs to go. So I'm born into a family in New York City. And my father passes away when I'm 6 years old. And my mom, who had never worked during her life, is now 33 years old and has a six-year-old, a five-year-old, and a seven-week-old, right? And my father had never been gainfully employed in his life. And so there were no veterans benefits, there were no pensions. There was no Social Security at the time, such as the way we think about it and know it now. And so she hit a trajectory that you would call poverty, welfare, and then a little bit of crime creeping in, you know, in, as a way to survive, right? And the home was not an orderly home at this point, right? So very messy. So we're the first kids in the neighborhood whose dad dies, and then you know with the dwindling and on fumes set of resources that we have, and you get the hand-me-down clothes going into school late all the time. Who knows what's going on with the food? You know, the whole thing is a mess, and she meets a lawyer. You know, has a somewhat close look at this set of situations and says, you know, I know a school for fatherless boys in Philadelphia. I know a school for fatherless boys. It's an original name, Girard College for Orphans, known more commonly as just Girard College. But, you know, you can steer your boys into that placement. So it would be, in effect, unloading the boys, you know, into that situation. And my mother did it. You know, she went to Philadelphia, and my brother and I, and we're something called Irish twins. I mean, I hope that doesn't offend any of the listeners that I use that phrase, but we're 11 months apart. So born in the same year. And we became wards of Philadelphia Orphans Court. And then I lived for the next 7 years with several hundred boys at Girard College. And I will tell you, like, so where does sports begin to intersect with all that, right? So my father, just to go back to my father again, who passed away when I was six, quite an athlete. You know, I have a clip of him boxing in the 1947 Golden Gloves, right? And knocks the guy out in 40 seconds, a TKO in 40 seconds. Tremendous athlete, tremendous with his hands. He's a great ball player and a great handball player. You and I know, being from New York City, the game of one wall handball.
Handball, right.
He is an absolute monster on the one ball handball court. He's a good baseball player. And the best sport for him
And
is
there was this thing
boxing.
where Irish were dominating the boxing at one time too.
Yeah, and of course, if he's of course he's a Sicilian, right? He was Sicilian, right? So, and people ask this: why would your mom do that rather than have the families come in? Well, it was kind of considered an interracial marriage at the time. My father grew up a Sicilian from Brooklyn. Both of his parents born and raised in Sicily. So he's this olive guy with the black hair, the black eyes. My mother's born and raised, her parents also both from Europe, Belarus and Poland. They grow up there, come here. She's this snow white, auburn haired a Jewish lady, right? So if this is like an interracial marriage back in the day, go back into the 50s, right? Early 50s. And so neither side wanted the kids. They didn't, they tolerated my dad because he was charismatic, guy's guy. While he was alive, he was tolerated by the Jewish side. My mother was never tolerated by the Sicilian side. They didn't like her from the beginning. They thought she was a prissy, spoiled brat. And so when he died, and there were no resources again, because you're never gainfully employed and never work anywhere. There's no pensions, there's no benefits, there's no nothing. Neither family wanted the ragtag children there,
What's the makeup of
those
the
babies.
students of the young people at the orphanage? What racial makeup?
Okay, so when I first enter Girard, right, it's all white, right? Because it's still
But break that
operating.
all white down into ethnic groups.
Right. Yeah, and I was it's a very good question that you ask. All white, I would say that the largest ethnic group is Italian. I mean, for a subset. No, I think most of the kids were actually come from Protestant backgrounds, actually, but the largest single group was Italian from South Philadelphia,
See,
right?
because when I think of sometime often, I'm thinking of sometime Irish.
So it's interesting, I mean, there are plenty of Irish kids that were there, but I would say as a large group, like in my own class, I want to say it was 25% of Italian kids from South Philadelphia, hardscrabble South Philadelphia, and so and plenty of kids from other backgrounds. In terms of kids with Jewish backgrounds, tiny minority. I mean, a speck.
And I'm assuming there was no black people there.
Not when I first came in, but by after I was there for 2 years. The integration, which had been court ordered a couple of years previously, began. And so by the time I left Girard 7 years later, we were reasonably integrated, right? I mean, I would say we were reasonably integrated. And a lot of my closest friends by the time I left were certainly some of the black kids they were like little brothers to me, right? I was a little bit older. The first black student graduated the year after me. But the school was integrating behind me the whole time. And so,
Well, let's talk about the sports program within this orphanage, within the school.
So it was interesting about sports and me. So, and baseball in particular, right? Because, you're the country's greatest baseball poet. So you want to know this story. So I had the talent. It was almost like at the level, like a gift, right? I had the talent. So I was the 9-year-old in New York City on the playground who could play with the 12 and 13-year-olds. And they had me right with them all the time. I'm out in center field and I can slap singles, right? So there I am, the only 9-year-old playing at that level. And so when I enter Girard, this is very protective of me. Can you imagine coming into a group of 120 boys in my age group was 120. Multiply that times like 10, 11, 8 different age groups. So it's hundreds of boys. And so to come into the school and have and immediately be the best baseball player in that group is very protective, right? Because in any group of boys like that, athletic capability is a big marker. Fighting capability and athletic capability would be your best bits of protection when you're 9, 10, 11, 12 years old.
This is a good place. Why don't you read your poem, Center Field?
In center field?
All right.
Okay. I can actually do that one by heart, so I will. I hope the listeners enjoy this. So it's called In Center Field. It happened on a summer day in 1965. Our softball season underway. The schoolyard was alive. I'd shagged fly balls in center field at least 1,000 times. The label on my glove had peeled. Like me, its age was 9. My dad had given me the glove the day that I was born. The gift outlived his hopeful love. By 6, my dad was gone. A boy without a father seeks a glade where he can grow, a place where nothing hurts or bleeds, a place where he feels whole. For me, that place was open sky on ground of black tar seal. While others tried in left and right, I thrived in center field. And so it came to pass that day, my solace was revealed. With ease, I'd made my umpteenth play, while others lurched and reeled. It melted through the sun's bright rays. I heard it soft and clear. His voice, I heard it plain as day. His voice caressed my ears. My gift, the voice intoned right through the schoolyard din. My graceful body is my own. My home is deep within. The revelation kissed my face and soothed my wounds inside. It told me how I'd find my place. It blessed my fragile life. A boy without a father seeks a glade where he can grow, a place where nothing hurts or bleeds, a place where he feels whole. Now, I've lost my way a dozen times and tossed away some years, been tagged out by my foolish pride and gagged on my own jeers. I want to hear the voice again. To feel at home, to yield, purge vain glory and false pain, to be in center field.
You're listening to the poetry of Stephen Biondo Leo. He is
Yes.
the author of Macaroni and Cheese Manifesto. That's the book that he's reading from. I go back and I listen to that poem, and it's the gift of the glove. It's the glove. It's not a bat, it's not a ball, but it's the glove. And it seems that there's something different from the bat and the ball.
It starts with the glove, right? So it starts with the glove. And of course, you and I know that's a contraction of the G for God and love, right? So we know that. So that poem, I'll say it for the audience. I don't often say it. Based on our actual thing that happened to me, it was a mystical experience. So I did hear that voice at 9 in the outfield. I was witnessing the fact that I had a kind of a gift beyond any of the urchins and cherubs around me, what they can do with the glove. And so there it was. So the poem's written in a way to show you when it says, my gift, we've got the question of who's saying that, put that on the side. It's designed so that when I go into school systems and I do that poem and I ask the students, what's the gift? They'll say, oh, the glove. But then what else is the gift? Oh, the relationship with the dad. Oh, the love between the dad and the son. Oh, the skill and talent the kid has. Oh, the kid himself is the gift. He's a gift to the world. And I say, that's it. I say, the next time someone tells you think you're God's gift to the world, say, yes. As a matter of
Yes,
fact, a poet came in and
I
told me I am God's gift to the world. What do you think of that?
am.
So it's written in a way so that it's a prism, right? That it's a prism, the glove and the gift's a prism. Everything in the world is a gift to you. The game of baseball, did you invent it? No, it was here before you came. The field is a gift. Your glove, the talent, the game itself is a gift. And of course, we all know baseball's a world unto itself, which is beautiful. So it's written that way. And then the voice, who was speaking, comes out of the blue, out of the air. Is it your subconscious? Is it your unconscious? Is it the Father? Is it God? Right. What?
But right, let's move away from God and baseball and get back to you, Stephen, because talking about baseball and everything, that's nice. But you had a very outstanding career as a wrestler.
I did.
Now, put baseball aside. What attracts you to wrestling? And can you speak about wrestling in the same sort of love that you just talked about baseball?
My baseball origin story is very profound, right? Because of, and that poem tries to capture it, right? At that age, I know, I've got this gift. And just to say just two little more things about baseball, and I take the hard switch to wrestling. I was the first 14-year-old in the history of Girard College to make varsity baseball, start every game, never be substituted again, just to double down on the reality of how that went. And I was a Division I a recruit, actually, in three sports, soccer, wrestling, and baseball. But so the baseball didn't like just go away at 9 years old, right after the poem. No. It hung in through high school. But I had my little experience as a 12-year-old. Listen to this. So I'm growing up in Pennsylvania now. And Pennsylvania, the main winter sport, the most glamorous winter sport in PA in the winter, I think, not basketball, but wrestling, right? It's the number one state. No one knows this.
You're only saying that, Stephen, because you're not 7 feet tall.
No, I could touch the rim.
You can't dunk.
I can't dunk. But I
can get back to wrestling.
So we'll get back to wrestling. So and at Girard, the glamour sport in the winter was wrestling. It's a bunch of boys. Who doesn't want to see a brawl, right? I mean, let's face it. So, and I'm coming out of New York City, right? And so here I am now, a fifth grader at Girard. Never heard of wrestling. Wrestling's like a TV spectacle. It's kind of crazy. It's theater. Who knows what it is? There's none of it in the New York City public schools. So I'm at Girard now, and I go to my first wrestling meet. This is a mind-boggling experience. First, it was hundreds of boys that have this poor other team hemmed in on a mat, and I'm watching fighting. I mean, this is like a legal thing that a school sanctions, and kids are walking out half naked onto a mat and beating the heck out of each other. I'm going, this is insane. And I'm thinking to myself, and I say this in the intro to my book, wait a minute. I'm like a shortstop in center fielder. That's sports. What is this? What is this crazy place? So in any case, the next year I find myself, recruited to wrestle on the team, and the older kids would train us and teach us. We were their little wrestlers. I'm a sixth grader at this point, but it turns out I do pretty well at this sport, right? I do well at it. The next year, when I start plugging into the school schedule of wrestling, I'm undefeated as an eighth grader. I'm a 12-year-old eighth grader, because a lot of us skip the seventh grade. So I'm a 12-year-old eighth grader. And what happens is, one match at the end of the season, varsity match, the 103-pounder is so sick, cannot show up for his match. Now, I'm an 88-pound, at the time, 88-pound eighth grader, 12 years old. And the school says, we are not going to give a forfeit in that weight class. Go to that junior high school team, get us somebody. They come down. They get me, 12 years old, 88 pounds. I go out, I'm plugged in, not at 95, which is the first weight class, because that guy's running an undefeated season. He's not going to risk losing. He's going to stay there. They're going to put me at 103. This kid's now 15 pounds heavier than I am. He's 16 years old. He's 4 years older. He's a head taller. And I sort of come out. When you come out, in the beginning of a wrestling meet, it is spine tingling. Hundreds of boys are screeching at the top of their lungs because it's like blood sport. We're going to kill all these guys. We're going to kill all these guys. Right? It's like insane. And I'm coming out with all these big kids. I'm in the lineup. This little guy is tiny. I'm up to the belly buttons. We're running out in the gymnasium, running around the mat, doing our little warm-up push-ups, whatever. Come back to the bench. It's like a state of rigor mortis, this setting. And I am so stone cold paralyzed. I can't believe I'm going to get to be thrown out onto a mat into a fight in front of a gazillion people. Well, it happened. I got thrown out onto the mat, and I land right there at the feet of the Jolly Green Giant. Right here I am, this tiny thing, 88 pounds, and I'm looking at this 103-pound kid who's a head taller than I am and 16 years old. Ready, wrestle. Okay, I get the takedown, hang on. I pick bottom, second period, whistle blows. I do what I'm trained to do. I do a sit out, turn, catch his head, pin him. The explosion in the gymnasium almost rocked the roof. And this is like one of the biggest high school gymnasiums in the United States. You'll have to see it one day. You'll come down. I will tour you. Unreal. I only two times in my life ever jumped up because I won. Because at the time, the ethos in wrestling, very gentlemanly. You stand up. There's no emoting. You shake your hands. You just beat a man. You do not emote. You don't want to be emoted against, right? So this to me was like almost a conversion experience coming off that undefeated experience. I said, this is the craziest game I've ever been part of, because the old expression, and there is a commonality between baseball and wrestling, by the way, which I'll say in a second.
And I want you to read your poem with hope. And why don't you read your poem with hope and heartbeat?
Okay. Can I say the commonality first? Right. Which is, it's an individual sport. Baseball is an individual sport at its essence. And your statistics are measured on you. You know, your fielding percentage and your batting percentage. All you, babe. All you.
If it's you know, the other sport like that, and I want to bring in because it's an excellent book. It's called Perfect in Their Art. Poems on Boxing from Homer to Ali that came out in 2003 by my friend, the editors, Robert Hardeen and Michael Waters. But it's a book all about boxing. You know, I guess we could also have one on wrestling also.
Oh, I love it.
So why don't you read with hope and heartbeat?
I'll give a read on with hope and heartbeat. Okay. No setup here. Let's just go into it. The wrestlers spring onto the mat, into the circle. Human cats, stunned and naked, bodies spare, relaxed and tense, inhuman stares. Their breathing seething, set to pounce as names and classes are announced. Into this moment, all contracts. As primal need strains towards contact. Their labors, dreams, and wills imbue this simple space, this time of truth, with meaning and transcendent power. The testing ground, the crowded hour, eternal struggle to control one's life, one's destiny, one's soul. Now here they stand, exploded view of human spirit, human roots. Upon a time in Greece and Rome, once wrestling champions were enthroned, assumed their places next to kings, inspiring throngs of men to sing a body song, a dancing chant of rhythm, beauty, stealth, and stance. All those who sought the place of Jove embraced the way of blood and bones. On this hard mat, in this cold hall, young lions wait the zebra's call. Though fear is near, desire strong, and to themselves they'll soon belong. One simple thing would make them whole. A single moment of control. In history, each seeks a home with hope and heartbeat like a poem.
You're listening to Stephen Biondolillo, who's reading from his book, Macaroni and Cheese Manifesto. Talk about not just sports, but and young people, but the coaches. You must have had some very good coaches that really inspired you, challenged you, and made you the person that you are today.
Absolutely. I can go further and say, without that, there's nothing. There's not.
And would these be like father figures, you know, replacing the father figures for you?
Oh, it's so, what a great question because it winds up touching a nerve in me. So yes, the first father figures do wind up in New York City still. You know, when I'm playing CYO baseball, you know, are the older teens in the neighborhood. I'm a young kid in the older teens and the young 20s take you under wing. And for me, again, remember I'd mentioned at the outset of the program, I'm the first kid in the neighborhood whose father died. And so what are you going to do? You're wandering around. There's a little fear associated with that. You know, life is very destabilized without the dad, your inner city kid. And, you know, and so the older teens taking you under wing, kind of protecting you, making a place for you in the group, right, was a wonderful thing. That's very protective and wonderful. And I'm endlessly grateful to those men, Bobby Davis, Johnny Finelli, Anderson, these guys, they were unbelievable. So then I come to Girard, and probably the first coach that has the same effect on me is a gentleman named Frank Sable, takes me under and really becomes, cares about us and our, and in sports, this is what I'm about to say is critical, our technical capability. A lot of people, you know, and particularly in a sport like wrestling, who's in shape and who can bang heads better? Well, how about this? Who can wrestle better? What do you know technically about the sport? And we were good. There was only one or two other schools whose kids learned as much technical as we did. Frank had, and we called him Crazy Frank. Crazy Frank had was number two in the U.S. Armed Forces Championships himself, had a bit of a background. He was one of us. He had grown up at Girard. Which was an interesting background to have, and did a good job of getting into us what we needed to win and made sure we were as in good shape as anyone when we got out there. And so that becomes sort of protective. For me, at the end of my career, there was an ugly twist with him, which what created the four-year hiatus in my sports, which was during my undergraduate years. The kind of unfortunate end was, and when I was 15, I placed fourth in the National Prep School Championships, and I was one of only two 15-year-olds to do that in that particular year. The next year, I'm seated first, and he wasn't letting me go at my weight class. So it's my original wound in life. And so I said, not going. If I can't go in my weight class and win my national championship, I don't want to be fed to the lions. So the bottom line is that was my first real major wound with a father figure in life. But I will say this about my baseball coach in high school who caught for Kansas City. Again, I've had a very lucky, privileged experience. His name is Ron Berta, 2 years in the show with Kansas City. He's in Moravian's Hall of Fame, Moravian College's Hall of Fame. He was technical. He gave me the underpinning as a teenager of technical baseball, the kind you get in the majors. So that was a big deal.
Have you taken some of these skills and do you coach in any capacity now?
So right now, no, but I coached all my kids, of course, in baseball. That was one. And then I was a favorite in my town, obviously, because I, you know, all dads in America, interestingly, you and I know this, all dads feel they're experts on baseball. But, you know, I actually kind of did get the pro training as a teenager. So, you know, it was a good thing for me to push myself up, be a baseball coach for all my kids. Also coached my daughter in soccer, and you know she went to top of D1 in college, and so I coached youth stuff. But more tellingly, on my biography, I was a Division I college wrestling coach for 5 years.
And you have to take some time out to write some poetry. So we're going to take a little break. You're listening to my friend Stephen B. DeLille. He is the author of Macaroni and Cheese Manifesto. And he's also the founder of the National Baseball Poetry Festival. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Peace. This is your social justice calendar for the week of April 14, 2025. Thursday, April 17th is the timely webinar, Lessons from South Korean Resistance to Authoritarianism and the MAGA Global Playbook, presented by the Institute for Policy Studies from 6 to 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. More info and registration can be found on ips-dc.org/events. Also on Thursday, April 17th from 6 to 8 p.m., nationally recognized writer Amanda Miller Littlejohn, author of The Rest Revolution, How to Reclaim Your Rhythm and Conquer Burnout When Overworking Has Become the Norm, is speaking at a book talk in Old Town Alexandria, Community Waterfront, 201 North Union Street, Suite 110, Alexandria, VA 22314. For more info, please visit restrevolutionbooktalk.eventbrite.com. The WPFW Social Justice Calendar connects you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. Submissions are due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Stephen Doolittle. Beyond Doolittle. Is that correct?
Beyond Doolittle. Beyond Doolittle. Beyond Doolittle. If you want to go with the Italian.
It sounds like we should be doing sculpture now.
Opera.
Okay. Steve, talk about your interest in sports and writing and how that interests with you being a pioneer in human service marketing and special event fundraising of nonprofits.
Okay. Could I just say one more thing about the coaching?
You do anything you want to do. This is your show.
Okay. I have to let you know why and how it was I got up to international class in wrestling, because you'd ask the very important question, you know, or the coaches, what was the role of the coaches? It was all the coach in that case. I wound up doing my graduate work in Canada at McGill University. And the coach there, we're going to go all the way back to 1978. I arrived there and I'm committed to coming back to wrestling. I'd had a bit of a hiatus. I just spent a year in France learning freestyle wrestling, but not without a good coach there. I'd gotten to wrestle the 125 and 136 pound national championships on a regular basis. They were beating me up. It was a great way to get back into it. But then I come into contact with the best wrestling technician in all of North America, Victor Zilberman, who was born and raised in Belarus and became a multiple-time Soviet national champion and world medalist. And at that time, especially, the Eastern Bloc wrestlers, the Russians in particular, were so head and shoulders above American technical wrestling, it was ridiculous. And I wound up wrestling in his room and for him for the sophistication and discipline of the Russian wrestling technical system. We wouldn't even be talking, because, you know, athletics so important, my whole identity, and we wouldn't even be talking. And so he instilled and drilled into all of us a level of technical competence that had me, could have been touch and go, could have wound up being nothing or something, where I was able to rise to international class. I got 5 medals in national and international competition, and 4 times I got to do international dual meets for Canada and the United States. So I couldn't have done that without this man and his genius, his particular technical genius. Wanted to say that because the debt of gratitude is so profound, and the proof of how you could take someone who could have been totally touch and go and not moved an inch forward after a 4-year hiatus, all of a sudden brought all the way back to that level in a 3-year period. Wow. That's what a coach can do. That's what technical competence and technical coaching.
Well, talk about what you're doing in this field of marketing, especially event fundraising.
Okay. So, all right. So where does that all stem from? You know, as an undergraduate, and I know we have something in common. I think one of your daughters went to Boston University, where I went as an undergrad. And my little avocation at Boston University was, I think I produced the greatest number of events while I was an undergraduate a student there. So I had almost, even though I'm a literature major, both in graduate and undergrad and grad, as an undergraduate, I'm producing events left, right. So I've got this in me now, right? And a little bit of that at Girard, going back to Philly and those first 7 years there. And so I'm in graduate school so long that by the time it comes time to get a job, I've already been producing a million things, supporting myself with projects. I say, why do that? I don't need a job. I could just keep doing projects. But where do I do projects? It's, where am I from? The system. I grew up in the system. So what do I know? Human services issues. Because I grew up with it. You know, hunger, homelessness, child welfare, all those lovely issues, right? That's where I'm from. So I start taking my events production skill set into that domain to help raise money. At the time, most people from the outside, if you weren't working in a nonprofit, you didn't make any money.
Right.
So I was really a pioneer of bringing large scale events into the nonprofit sector. Now,
and you were doing these marathons, right?
Walkathons. Right. And so the first major activity I did when I was out there, I had a wife, a new baby, and I'm trying to make a living, make a go of myself, was we created in the wake of the when Reagan had come in, he had sort of clamped down on the amount of money spilling into the nonprofit sector, and sort of the world transitioned from federal government block grants were coming down into the community, and then community groups were giving contracts to people to get various work done. I got picked up for $9,000 to clean up all the parks in a neighborhood in Boston in the course of the summer. And what I did is I created a program called the Grime Fighters, which was, okay, gonna hire kids that are hired with anti-poverty money in the summer, 14 to 17 year olds. Usually they were make work and no show jobs. Now I'm gonna make them work. I'm gonna get out there, we're gonna supervise the kids, we're gonna give them a good work experience. The federal government will pay their wages. I'll brand the program. The Grime Fighters will get the t-shirts. It'll be great. And we'll end the summer with the first ever Olympic style competition in cleanup, the National Grime Fighter Games. And we'll invite kids in from all over, and they'll compete in the four-way bag fill and two-way hand pick and the shovel carry and all these
things are denied by the Olympic Committee.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, when we first called ourselves the National Grime Fighter Olympics, the IOC wrote to us and said, you can't do that. I said, we're a little tiny thing in Boston. Do I have to hear from the IOC? I did have to from the IOC. So here's where it ends up. Within 10 minutes, we were in 22 cities and states actually running professionally youth cleanup programs and having kids come in from all over the United States to compete in six skills in competitive format in the National Grime Fighter Games. And so the success of this program over 5 or 6 years led Boston's largest walkathon, which is one of the largest, I think the largest walkathon in the United States, a $400,000 or $500,000 walkathon, to come to me and say, look, we saw what you did over here with all these kids and the Grime Fighters. You think you could help us? Probably. Have you ever been in a walkathon? No. You ever seen one? No. You ever contribute to one? No. But I'm willing to help. So we came in, we looked at it, and literally in the 6 month period from yes, I'll help, we created the world's first $1 million walkathon. I'd kind of come up with all sorts of things that had never been done in that space, created a new sponsorship model, refocused people on recruiting people from where they lived to where they worked, treated the event like it was a premier property, like it was pro sports, and therefore getting media sponsorship, all kinds of changes we instituted. It was instant magic, and we became the world's first $1 million walk.
Well, let's talk about the magic, because you've also created the National Baseball Poetry Festival. What gave rise to that creation?
So now you're at the sort of other side of my career, because we thought this went up about 5 years ago, but really we've only been at it now for 31 months. So the concept came 5 years ago. So just so the audience is clear, in that 35 year space, we'd actually been not only the people that brought the walkathon world to scale, but
it was during the same time that the Avengers were disbanded, right?
Yeah. we also developed an educational model that taught most of the nonprofits in the United States who use that as a primary form of fundraising. And so what we did in effect was grow a $2 billion industry. In 1984, if you looked at a walkathon type fundraising, walkathons, bikeathons, about a $20 million trickle. By the time we were done with that space, it was a $2 billion industry. 84, no full-time employees. And 20 years later, 20,000 full-time employees. So in a sense, we were the main catalyst in the growth and development of a space that created 20,000 jobs and $2 billion worth of revenue for public health organizations. At the same time, we were inventing for nonprofits a lot of wildly creative new kinds of events, which is where the baseball thing will stem from. It's been what we've done for the past 35 years to invent new things. So what stimulated this in particular, like the genesis story for the National Baseball Poetry Festival? So you now know that baseball is like almost spiritually fundamental to me, right? Mm-hmm. I had an encounter at 9 years old, and we'll leave it right there. We don't need to go any deeper. And you knew it was protective of me as a child. And we know that now. So, you know, it's never far from me, baseball. Great. So I'm sitting, I'm reading a magazine from the West Coast, and I stumble on an article about the Fisherman's Poetry Festival. And I literally, like lightning, am stopped cold. I, what? There's a, and I know the Cowboy.
You're right.
I know the Cowboy Poetry Festival. Cowboy, all right, I understand that lifestyle, you know, whatever. Fisherman? Seriously? I was an English major in undergrad. Dude, we don't have that many poems on fish. So I say, wait a minute. Okay, think logically. Commercial fishing. All right, there's a world there. The recreational fishing. Oh, world there. Then I think sport fishing. Sport? And like lightning. I went, what? How come there's no baseball poetry festival? Just like that. Mm-hmm. It's the exact logic. I thought commercial, recreational, sport, where's my baseball festival? Boom, Casey at the bat. It instantly pops to mind. Of course, I know enough about literature to know that's just down the road here in Worcester. You know, Ernest Thayer's born and raised in Worcester. And of course, Worcester has that great history. They've got Ernest Thayer's birthplace and where he's reared. They've got the first perfect game is pitched there. They're the heart of the industrial leagues at the end of the 19th century. This is incredible. And we just had the whole a situation where the Paw Sox became the Woo Sox, you know, where the, you know, where that happened. And we've now got the shiniest, brightest, newest, best run AAA park in America. Wonderful team out there, by the way, and you'll meet them soon, Ethelbert. And I said, got to do it. Now, mind you, I said, got to do it. Took 2 years. Took 2 years to get off the ground, right? Had to talk to a whole lot of people, the top business leaders, the Chamber of Commerce in Worcester, they're the MVPs in the whole game. Tim Murray, the head of the chamber, and his whole team put a citywide committee together, et cetera. The Woo Sox themselves, Dr. Charles Steinberg, Larry Lucchino's best friend, you know, all behind it, his staff, Ryan Nesbitt, the whole crew there, Joe Bradley, who's now over at Harvard, all these guys, you know, really, it was an entire city came together. But that still took a little bit of time, to get all the pieces. But once we pressed the go button on September 29th, 2023, 7 months later, we had our first National Baseball Poetry Festival. Little respite. We did the second cycle. And now this year we're going into the third cycle of it. And of course, we're honored to have you, Ethelbert, going to be with us and joining us this year. We can't wait. We We've got the people from SABRE, the Society of American Baseball Research, on hand. We've got two or three of the big baseball publication publishers will be on hand. You yourself, Bill Littlefield from It's Only a Game will be there. It's going to be marvelous. We can't wait to welcome.
You're really targeting young people, though, with this.
Two things. We're trying to create, you know, like a good festival, a gathering and a community for people who care about baseball and art. Right. Of course, poetry at the center of it. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, you and I know that baseball is the most represented sport in the fine arts. Film, theater, music, opera, poetry, everything. Boom, done. So we are already starting to creep organically. We'll have Jeff Brain's work there. I know you know Jeff, the beautiful,
right,
beautiful illustrator. We've got the composer of the Casey at the Bat mini opera will be there singing for us. So grounded in poetry, but so it's two things. It's the gathering and community of people who love baseball and art, and it's also the lifeline for kids who are now living in a world where the arts are under attack and being squeezed out of middle school, high school curriculums, and the humanities are under attack, being squeezed out even at the university level, because there's no ROI. When you're dealing with the young kids, look, we all know STEM education is critical and we live in a technical world. Got it. Bottom line, can't be squeezing the arts out. You know, science, technology, engineering, math, wonderful, let's do it. Gotta carry the humanities along. Philosophy, religion, literature, complet, art history, all those subjects where the university starts actually in the Middle Ages with those subjects.
Well, let's go back into what you start. Let's go back and start. Look at how you started your book. In your introduction, you mentioned that there's at least two criteria that you think a poem should meet. And you talk about clarity and emotional impact. Expand on that.
Yes, I will. It's interesting. You know, poetry gets a bad rap often because people don't get it, right? They don't understand it.
They don't get baseball.
Well, that's another thing. Right? Baseball's a whole another story, right? But and you know, baseball. Remember when you and I grew up, baseball was still the number one sport, and all the best athletes were in it. You remember that? I remember it. Now, a lot of competition with the other sports. It's not exactly true. Whatever. We'll put that on the side, though, for a moment. So, when you look at how I write, right? So I write first. Who do I write for? So people say, "Who's your audience, Steve?" Well, I say this: it's men and women of action. Men and women of action. That's my audience, which means I have a lot of pressure to carry a narrative line in my poems. There's got to be a little story in there that we're tracking, so that there's some clarity, there's some narrative line, right? Regardless of how much, you know, imagery you've got pumped in there and how many metaphors you're working with.
You're going to tell me that you're the founder of spoken words.
No.
I'm just following along with what you're saying about clarity. Yeah.
It has to be that, though, right? For me. And then also you'll notice sort of the structure and rhyme in mine also. Right. You know, there's meter and rhyme in most of what I write, and the poems that you've selected, except for my aphoristic one, is meter and rhyme, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and then there's some little bit of gravitas of subject matter so that it's moving, right? Because my audiences are, you know, the firemen, you know, athletes, right. Military personnel. Look at my LinkedIn photo. That's me.
Oh, you're like Naruto going into a factory, you know?
Yeah. I love that. Or Philip Levine also had a little bit of that taste.
Yeah, the working class poet.
Little bit of that, right? Mm-hmm. So, but I'm very proud of that. And that my LinkedIn picture is me chatting with 360 military officers at U.S. Army War College. That's my picture on there. I'm doing my 9/11 poem, which is called 480 BC, mm-hmm. right? Where I make a parallel between what the Greeks did at Thermopylae in 480 BC in saving democracy, and what happened with the firemen at the World Trade Center debacle, which you referenced to me when we were offline. You know, so I think poetry is well served to come back to some basics and some of its core original strength, whether you're looking at an Iliad, an Odyssey, or how we used to carry the human story orally in rhyme as a way of carrying our story.
When I listen to this, and we're coming to the end of our show, but when I listen to what you're saying, Steve, it reminds me, and you make reference to his work, and I think about Dana Joy, what he was at NEA, and he also he wrote this essay called Does Poetry Matter, which was, you know, people were discussing it, you know, from coast to coast. And so I guess I bring that question back to you. If it does matter, how does it matter? Why does it matter?
Oh, my goodness. To me, because now you're talking to a poet, so it's everything, because it literally cuts through all the clutter and speaks to the very essence of who you are, what you are, how you are, and why you are. So, you know, we can all work in fields that are essential, right? There's a difference between essential and building the world around us and making it capable for us to move day to day. But then there's the unseen dimension of the world. That why are you living? Why? What do you live for? Right? How are you living? I get, and how you plug in and what you build to make all that possible for all of us. But the why question, the what beauty, truth, love, wrestling with death. This is the world of poetry, relationships. Right. The wordsmiths and makers who are wrestling with the profoundest issues. Again,
you know, that raises, you know, I always talk to when I meet, you know, poets, you know, I talk about, you know, there's only two things you really should think about. Who are you and why are you here? Yeah. You know, and these are these big philosophical questions that sometimes you could be in an MFA program and never address. You're writing your poems, but you never sit down and say, okay, who am I? Why am I here?
Exactly.
Let me ask you one last question, Stephen. I put a lot of emphasis on documentation and preservation. When we look at the National Baseball Poetry Festival, do you have a documentation unit or where that, okay, I'm bringing these people together, should it be interviews, should it be, you know, what should happen when you bring all these people together?
Yeah, so you know, so the festival itself is comprised of four events. There's a welcome reception, then there's a poets to poets sort of reading and panel, and you are going to be the feature, obviously, on the panel this year. Then there's an open mic event, and then there's a youth reading and spectacle. And so we will have videography on all four of those occasions. You will be interviewed, my guess is twice or three times during it. So we'll have that much.
My contract says once.
When they shove that mic in your face, I think you're going to say a couple of words.
Yeah, that's why I'm shoving the mic back at you. Right? Well, Steve, we're going to have to wrap up here. You know, if we say the baseball is a game, it never ends. But our conversation, unfortunately, has to end this morning. And I want to thank you for taking time out of your schedule, because I know that you're extremely busy. And so I just want to thank you. And I tell you, you know, the reason why I like your last name is because I grew up with Bill Mambouquet. so when I say Bill Dolillo, you know, and so I just want to say to my guests, I'm talking to Stephen Beyond Dolillo.
Beyond Dolillo, if
right?
You're American or Beyond Dolillo?
Lillo. Right. Now you're stretching, Lilo. Okay? Right.
Beyond
Dolillo. Right. Okay. And that is BIONDOLILLO. Okay.
You got it.
And he is the author of Macaroni and Cheese Manifesto. Thank you very much, and many blessings. You are a national pastime.
thank you so much. It's been a delight. Thank you so much.
Okay, you're listening to On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
WPFW commemorates the birthday of James Joseph Brown on May 3rd from 7 a.m. to midnight. Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, will feature his music, delve into his complicated and tumultuous family history and sometimes troubling behavior, and celebrate his artistic, entrepreneurial, and activist legacy, including James's live performances in Ghana, Zambia, and Zaire, present-day DRC. That's Revolution of the Mind, Unpacking the Genius and Torment of James Brown, Saturday, May 3rd, 7 a.m. to midnight on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time. Full schedule found on WPFWFM.org.
WPFW has been a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture for 48 years. Our spring membership drive begins with a special celebration of James Brown's birthday, May 3rd, and closes with a centennial birthday celebration of Malcolm X on May 19th. Two pillars of music and message. Your financial sustenance is needed more than ever to continue this type of programming. As a new listener or current member, this is your opportunity to contribute to the growth of an institution that stands resolute against both gross injustice and repression and the mass erasure of history and culture by amplifying the voices of scholars, artists, and activists whose work centers the humanity of all people. That's 48 years of being a site of resistance in defense of truth, justice, and culture, May 3rd through the 19th. WPFW works daily to build the world we want to inhabit by building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration on Friday, April 25th, 7 to 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt. Entertainment includes Navasha Daya and more. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
Greetings. WPFW is pleased to announce the relaunch of our major donor program, now known as the Jazz and Justice Circle. If you gave $1,000 last year or so far this year, you are automatically enrolled in this cherished group of listener members, and we thank you. Benefits of your membership are at WPFWFM.org under the Support Us tab at the top of the homepage is the Jazz and Justice Circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at WPFWFM.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. For nearly five decades, support from listeners like you has kept WPFW's wheels rolling. In fact, the single largest category of donations comes from those who donate an unused car to the station. That's right, running or not. Even a car sitting idle that needs thousands of dollars in repairs can do wonders for WPFW. If you can't drive it, donate it. WPFW will get the proceeds, and you'll get a tax break. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
In commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the end of the U.S. war in Vietnam, Busboys and Poets, along with the Institute for Policy Studies, will host Vietnamese poet and novelist Nguyen Phan Ke Mai in conversation with Vietnam veteran Wayne Carlin in a program moderated by E. Ethelbert Miller on Thursday, April 24th from 6 to 8 p.m. At the event, 50 years after the end of the Vietnam War, A Pathway Toward Healing and Reconciliation, K-Mai will read from her new book of poems, The Color of Peace, and Wayne will read from his latest book, Memorial Days, Vietnam Stories, 1973 to 2022. That's 50 years after the end of the Vietnam War, A Pathway Toward Healing and Reconciliation, Thursday, April 24th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Tacoma Busboys and Poets. More information and how to RSVP can be found online, ips-dc.org/events. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world one broadcast at a time.